thought I'd start with a little bit of slow radio for you. That's the sound of rain on my shed where I do all my riding on the turbo. Just a quick heads up, it's Tom here, hello. This episode is, well, it's in two parts, really. The first part is all about core temperature. There is a new core temperature sensor on the market, which a lot of the pro teams are using, and it's some very interesting stuff. The second part, it's a late addition. It's been something I've been trying to get hold of for a while. I chat with Trainer Road about their new adaptive training scheme, which uses machine learning and AI, something that I'm absolutely fascinated by. So that's the second part of the show, so stay tuned for that. Anyway, let's have a little bit more slow radio. Now on with the show.
You are listening to Service Course by the Cycling Podcast with Lizzie Banks and Tom Whalley.
Well, no Lizzie Banks this month, but I have got a fantastic substitute here. I'm joined by Ian Boswell. Ian, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Tom. It's good to be on. I've been a little bit absent from joining you or Richard, Lionel and Daniel on the cycling podcast, but still around and yeah, survived another winter here in New England and happy to be back on and joining you all.
Well, it's for me, actually, this is great actually, because most people listening to this will have heard the Young Americans episode that Rich went out to visit you and Larry and Joe Dombrowski in Nice, and then we did two episodes out there. I actually made those episodes of the podcast, but we've never actually, I mean, I've edited your voice a thousand times, but we've never actually spoken. So this is quite nice for me. I feel like I know you already.
Yeah, well, I've definitely heard your voice, and I hear your credit at the end of some episodes that you have edited and produced. So it's nice to actually finally, I guess, meet you. I can see you on my screen. Everyone else can't see you, but I sure can.
For everyone listening, Ian sat in a car, by the way. I was hoping he was going to be in his beautiful Vermont home, you know, show me all the beautiful foliage out there. But no, sat in the back of his car.
Yeah, I'm sat in my truck outside a friend's house down the road a little ways, just because while our house is beautiful and gorgeous, it's old and the Wi-Fi is... It exists, but it's not up to snuff when it comes to trying to do a video conference call and upload podcast files. So that's where I'm at.
Well, there's loads of stuff, loads of interesting stuff in this episode. The main conversation is going to be about the new core temperature sensor, which a lot of the pro teams are using. And I know you, Ian, you've had some experience of doing some core temperature testing when you were with Sky. But before we get to that sort of stuff, just a little bit of a catch-up, really, because obviously when we've heard from you over the last few months and, well, the last 12 months really beyond, we've talked a lot about how you've gone from riding in the World Tour and you know, you had to retire due to your concussion, and you've talked a lot and very eloquently about your recovery from that. And I just want to sort of touch base with you and find out where you're at now in that recovery, because it is a long process, isn't it?
Yeah, it definitely is a long process. And, you know, one thing that I've kind of learned along the way is that, you know, concussion is very unique to, you know, it's like a fingerprint. Every time you hit your head or, you know, suffer a concussion, the recovery process and just the, you know, kind of the way back to, you know, whatever 100% is different. You know, I'm happy to say that I'm, you know, I feel very much kind of, I would say, normal again. You know, there's still slight instances where I notice I'm not the same as I was before, especially, you know, under extreme fatigue, or, you know, I still struggle to, don't tell my gravel competitors, but I still struggle with left-hand turns. And that's both, you know, on the bike and skis, which I've been doing more this year. I think the biggest thing is just being aware of it, you know, and just being aware that, you know, concussions definitely add up upon each other, and just being, you know, that level of risk that I'm not willing to take anymore, even though I still love riding, I still love, you know, skiing and doing other, you know, adventure sports. Just being a little bit more cautious and being aware that, you know, another hit to the head is, you know, that's just one more tally and kind of an exponential, you know, risk that I'm, you know, potentially exposed to, given my history with concussion. And, you know, we've seen kind of recently in the World Tour some more kind of imposed, I think it was just this year, that the UCI implemented a new concussion protocol, which is definitely a step in the right direction. I think, you know, myself and some other people I communicate with regularly would like to see more steps happen and kind of at a quicker rate. But that said, you know, it is a step in the right direction. And I guess myself, coming from the world of cycling, I know that sometimes things move very slowly. However, a friend did just send me a study, and I think it's coming out of the UK, that there is potentially a new test where a saliva test can identify concussion, which would be great because, you know, George Bennett had that crash in Perry Nice, and I think a lot of people had assumed he had a concussion. I actually texted him right away because some people reached out to me and said, hey, you should reach out to George. But it's, you know, really, it's so hard. It really needs to be a cultural shift in the sport, because it's the cyclists that want to get back on the bike and keep racing and riding. You know, it's oftentimes the directors and coaches and, you know, doctors might spot something, but they ask the rider, and, you know, you become very good at, you know, kind of hiding injury and illness to make sure you can get back on the bike and continue racing. But yeah, it's a progression. And, you know, I think that we're definitely in the right direction, just that it's being talked about and being kind of shared amongst riders and media that it, you know, we are making progress.
I mean, as a viewer, it's been, I mean, we did it, actually, Lizzie and I did an episode on, well, we're talking about helmets, but obviously within that concussion came up and concussion protocols. And actually, as watching cycling, you know, it does appear different. Even the commentators are dealing with it in a different fashion, certainly this season. And I was wondering what you made of the way Theo reacted when, you know, he had his head injury at Paris-Nice.
Yeah, no, I mean, hats off to Theo for, you know, not being afraid to, you know, actually, to be honest, it was Theo the one that kind of sent me a message notifying me about what George had experienced. But yeah, I mean, credit to Theo and to the Ineos team for actually taking it serious and realizing that, you know, concussion can have a long-term effect. And you think about, you know, teams that do have riders on longer-term contracts, and not saying that, you know, teams that don't shouldn't be, you know, the same level of just awareness. But, you know, if you put an athlete back on his bike, you know, before he's fully recovered, you know, you're exposing them to potentially, you know, crashing again, and then, you know, really severe injury with, you know, kind of multiple concussion syndrome. So I think it really, like, again, it, you know, people like Theo, you know, he has obviously an incredibly big voice now after winning the Giro, and, you know, he's done a lot of, you know, posts and sharing just around, you know, social equality as well. And so it's awesome that he's actually using his platform now and his voice to make a positive change in, you know, in sport, but also, you know, beyond sport. I think it's, you know, people like him are needed to kind of push the needle.
Well, you touched on it, you know, you touched about your gravel riding, because that's obviously the next phase in your career. I wanted to find out how the gravel season's going. I mean, is there a gravel season? Because obviously that's your new thing, is this gravel adventure racing that you're sort of focusing on these days. Have you got started? How's the training going? Any races planned, that sort of stuff?
Yeah, well, I retired from professional road racing, and had 2020 was a big year to kind of transition and kind of figure out gravel racing and riding. And, you know, I put together a project. You know, I'm working at Wahoo, so they're kind of the, you know, my title sponsor. I also have a full-time job there, but was able to piece together some other partners and bikes and all that, and was gung-ho for 2020. I was actually over in Nice, did a training camp over there last February, and returned to the U.S. to realize that I still have not done a big gravel event. So hopefully sometime soon. It looks like there's an event happening in May down in Arkansas. So events are slowly starting to kind of happen, and, you know, the U.S. has been relatively effective at rolling out the vaccine. I was actually able to get I received both doses of my vaccine because I'm on the local volunteer fire department here in Peacham. So as a first responder, I was able to get vaccinated. So a little bit more comfortable traveling, and I foresee that events will come back in some capacity here in North America this kind of maybe late spring, early summer. You know, which events like this, you know, these gravel events are so different than professional road racing, because they're very much, you know, it's participation, and then you can't have, it's hard to create a bubble like you could in the World Tour, where, you know, you can run tests on, you know, 200 athletes. Some of these events have, you know, 3,000-4,000 people plus families, and they're traveling from all over. So a lot more kind of, you know, caution and, you know, protocol needs to be in place for them to happen safely.
Well, it's good to hear you've had your jabs. I had my first jab as well. How did it knock you out, by the way? I was absolutely floored by mine.
I was not, surprisingly. I definitely, the day after my second one, I felt a little bit strange, but just like a little bit cold and feverish as well. But no, I was fine afterwards, thankfully. So yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I've read some stuff, whether it, the effectiveness if you don't have symptoms, but for whatever reason, I noticed it, but I wasn't on the couch, you know, conked out all day.
Well, the only reason I mention it is I've been warning, you know, when I speak to sort of pro athletes and people planning for events, you know, carefully plan when you're going to get that jab, because, you know, you don't want to be in a big race 3 or 4 days later and feeling ropey. Back on the gravel stuff, though, so let's talk about your setup then. So I'm fascinated, you know, someone who's come out from riding in the World Tour to then, you know, complete sort of change of focus. Presumably you've been experimenting with different setups on your gravel bike. What have you found? What do you like? What's working for you?
Yeah, it's a completely different world coming to gravel, you know, especially in the World Tour. You know, you're very much riding the equipment that the team's partnered by, and more often than not, you know, the mechanics, you know, deal with tire pressure and what tire you're going to ride. You know, you have very little kind of influence over the equipment side of things. You know, obviously some riders at the top end are able to, you know, select a special tire, and, you know, teams have kind of been more switched on to adjusting tire pressure to specific stages and tires and conditions. But gravel is completely different. You know, I started off racing on the road. You know, my dad was a triathlete, so I started doing time trials on, you know, 19 mil tires with like 150 PSI in it. And so my mentality from a young age was like, all right, whatever the tire says the maximum PSI or bar is, you know, put in an extra couple pumps and, you know, get the most out of it. It's going to be the fastest. But
I still believe that's the fastest. Honestly, I still do.
Yeah, rock hard. So I've learned a lot about, you know, just the equipment side of it, especially, you know, in gravel, everyone's running tubeless tires. You know, the tires are, you know, so important just for, because you have to think, you know, really the course with speed, and, you know, you don't want to puncture, you want to make sure you have traction, but you also need to go fast. So I've been definitely experimenting with different tires and kind of learning what's optimal. But, you know, surprisingly enough, I've found that a bigger tire with lower PSI is not much slower than, you know, even a road tire. You know, I'm riding with Specialized tires, and I have the Pathfinder, which is like my favorite
I use the same ones here. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. And it literally, I did a 200 mile ride last summer. It's probably like 50% dirt, 50% pavement. And, you know, I started like the night before thinking, all right, how long this is going to take me? You know, there's a lot of climbing, but I still did almost 20 miles an hour average on, you know, a 38 mil tire with, you know, I guess it has a file tread in the, you know, it's a hard tire in the center, but there's some grip on the side. And, you know, especially for the roads around here in Vermont, you know, they're oftentimes the dirt roads are in better condition than the pavement. It's not much slower. And I remember talking to Larry Warbass afterwards, and he's like, oh, dude, that's crazy. That's such a slow tire. I'm like, it's really not that much slower. And a couple of years ago when I was racing at Katusha with Harry Tanfield, you know, he was pushing our mechanics so hard because he wanted to run tubeless tires. You know, he wanted to run low PSI, like around like 80 PSI. And the mechanics were just like, who is this British kid? He doesn't know anything about, you know, what is he talking about? You know, we're on 23 mil tubulars at, you know, 100 PSI. That's what we run. And, you know, he'd done so much testing on the track that he knew that, you know, especially on the road, once you have rough surface, that, you know, a bigger tire, lower PSI is going to be faster.
Well, it's interesting you talk about that. We've talked about Harry Tanford as well with his particular setups and stuff. Whenever I talk to pros, I'm always really interested into finding, you know, what their sort of relationships were with bikes. As a pro, were you someone who was pushing your mechanic to change things, to experiment? Do you have a very clear vision for how things should be set up?
No, I'm pretty blasé when it comes to that. You know, like I said, I'm really at this point in my life is when I'm actually learning how to work on my own bike and, you know, figure out what does work. You know, I was definitely one that would just kind of take the mechanic's advice or, you know, see what another rider on the team was doing. I do recall one stage of Tour of Switzerland, or maybe it was Tour Romandy, but there was a prologue and it was pouring rain. And I was like, run the tire. I wasn't going to win it. I wasn't even in contention. And the mechanic asked me what I wanted tire pressure. And I was like, oh, I don't know, like as low as you can go, like, you know, 80, 85. I just want to make it around this prologue. And Vasil Kirienka told him that he wanted 13 bar in his tire, which is like 120 some odd PSI. And everyone's like, you know, Kiri, what are you thinking running so much pressure in this rain? He's like, oh, because it pushes the water away from the tire. And, you know, it's just this, you know, Belarusian mentality, like, let's just go as hard as we can. And he didn't crash, and I think he did a decent ride, but it's, you know, I guess there is some sense of, you know, placebo in there. If you think it's working, you might be a little bit more confident on your tire.
But I mean, as well, like, you know, going through your career, then was there ever sort of a bike that you would, I mean, you don't have to name names, but was there ever a bike that you were genuinely unhappy with? You just couldn't get on with?
You know, to be quite honest, I always struggled to actually fit on the Pinarello. And nothing against them. I mean, they were fantastic bikes, but just, I think the geometry of it with my kind of, you know, physiology, I don't have, you know, I'm 6'3". I don't have incredibly long legs, but I have a long torso. You know, so I was riding a 56 centimeter frame to kind of get my saddle height in the right position. But then I had to run, you know, either a 130 or 140 stem, which, you know, that's a pretty long stem. And, you know, pros are, you oftentimes see a long stem and stretched out and slammed. But, you know, it's just different to see the kind of the geometry of, you know, maybe an Italian frame builder compared to, you know, what I'm on now, a Specialized, where I can ride a 58 centimeter frame and run a more normal length stem, you know, like a 120, and just be a bit more, you know, kind of centered on the bike. And it's just, you know, I think it's really just, you know, some people fit on different bikes differently. And even though it's, you know, people say that this day and age, you know, bike, the industry has gone, you know, you see more bikes that are similar, but, you know, it really is a case of finding that geometry that fits you and that bike that fits you perfectly. And, you know, I guess maybe a tall American rider like me just fits better on a bike designed here in the US.
Well, like I say, you've been watching loads of pro racing, as have I. You know, Paris, Tirreno Adriatico have been on at the same time. We've had Milan San Remo. I'm just wondering, as a pro, when you're tuning in to watch races, especially having, you know, not ridden in the World Tour for a couple of years now, what you spot in watching those races? I mean, and particularly, I guess, when you're watching the time trials, I imagine there's quite a lot of tech to spot. But have you picked up anything from watching racing this season?
I mean, the biggest thing that I've noticed in time trials is the positions have really gone. People look way more comfortable on time trial bikes now than they did, you know, even when I was racing. You know, you see these positions that are much higher. You look at someone like Dowsett, even Rohan Dennis, like they're sitting pretty high on the bike, but, you know, they're able to, you know, kind of close off that frontal area by bringing their bars up or angling, you know, their hands to a position where they're actually able to kind of start to break the wind at their hands, but then, you know, that pushes the air around kind of this gap, which, you know, is between their legs and their torso. And it's, you know, it looks a lot more comfortable for a time trial position to be sitting up a little bit higher than trying to slam it all the way down. And I guess to that, you can also really tell which riders and teams have invested in. You see a lot of these custom TT bars now that are, you know, either 3D printed or, you know, custom built to follow the contour of a rider's arm. And you can even start to identify which teams kind of are putting money towards certain athletes. You know, I think was it last year in the Giro, I noticed that Teo had custom bars, but Jai Hindley didn't. And, you know, I mean, I think Teo would have won regardless, but, you know, you just start to think about these little details. And I think it just, the sport in general continually becomes, you know, closer and closer, and all these little, you know, fine details really do start to add up, because it, you know, at the top end, it's micro, you know, seconds that are ultimately separating some, you know, riders from first and second. And it's been, it's been interesting to see the evolution of time trial. I think that's where you definitely see things come into play at the beginning of, you know, what's going to happen, and eventually on road bikes is what people are using in their TT position.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, interrupting this month's episode of Service Course with Tom Wally and Ian Boswell to remind me, Richard Moore, to tell you that it is sponsored by Babbel. Babbel, the language learning app. Now, I'm currently at E3 Harelbeke in Flanders, and usually there'd be a hubbub of voices, a babel, in fact, of voices and crowds, because it's one of the best supported races on the calendar normally. Not this year, sadly, but hopefully we will all be able to come out and watch the races and travel again soon. One thing we can do in the meantime is, in preparation for travelling, begin to learn a language. And I can recommend Babbel because it's easy, fun and flexible. You can squeeze 5, 10, 15 minute lessons in whenever you have some spare time, and you can even pause mid-lesson if you need to. Babbel uses real life conversations to teach the language that you happen to be learning, and you learn through interactive dialogues. Speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent. Lessons are lovingly created by over 100 language experts, real people, and not by a machine. So you learn useful vocabulary and not meaningless phrases. Babbel's recently launched some podcasts as well, so you can brush up on your Spanish or French while cooking or exercising. And if you've listened to all your episodes of the Cycling Podcast, of course. With Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. And Babbel is available as an app or online, and your progress will be synced across all devices. I've been using it for several months to improve my French, and as I say, it's a lot of fun, but I also feel that I'm making real progress as well, and a lot of that is thanks to Babbel. Right now, Babbel is offering our listeners 6 months free with a purchase of a 6 month subscription using the promo code CYCLE. Go to babbel.co.uk/play and use the promo code CYCLE on your 6 month subscription. That's babbel.co.uk/play, promo code CYCLE. Now back to Tom and Ian.
Well, interesting you mentioned about stuff we've spotted, and this brings us on to the interview I'm going to play in a second. Ian, when you were riding, and now as well, I guess, what is on your power meter? What fields are you most interested in? What are you reading?
Yeah, so I have a Roam display from Wahoo, and that's like the, you know, the bigger kind of more adventure type screen. And I have, this is actually something that, kind of going back to time trialing, I've just put on average speed as a field that I look at, you know, and that's something interesting because as a racer, I was so worried about power, you know, so I would have, you know, my 3 second average, I would have average power, you know, I'd have distance, you know, I guess in a race, you know, lap distance, lap time. But very seldom would I actually look at speed. And it's only now that I'm retired, funny enough, that I realize that speed wins races and not power. And I think that, you know, especially growing up in the US where we're a culture, probably similar in the UK, a culture of numbers and data that, you know, oh, I did this many watts. It's like, well, that didn't win the race. What won the race is who went the fastest. So, I have time, distance, average speed, current speed, power, and heart rate as well. Those are the main fields that I'll look at, especially if I'm doing some type of, you know, interval or event. But it is amazing to think that, you know, I went so many years worried, especially in a race, worrying about my power more so than worrying about the actual speed, which is, like I said, it's ultimately speed is what counts when it comes to racing.
I think you went the opposite way to me because I was always just obsessed with average speed. And then as soon as I got a power meter, I found things got really boring. You know, I started trading to power and it just wasn't as fun as just trying to keep your speed up the whole time. But one thing that's been spotted in the Peloton this year, and quite a few pro teams are using them, is core temperature sensors. So a lot of the teams will now on their head units have core temperature displayed. So I wanted to find out a bit more about this, and I spoke to some people behind a brand new sensor that a lot of the pro teams are using.
Well, I'm Chris Blumfield-Brown, the product manager for Core. And Core is a new sports technology or even medical technology that monitors your core body temperature with a new second sensor technology that we've developed in Switzerland.
So, I mean, you said there, you talked about sports in general. Obviously, we're going to talk more about cycling specific. But what is your sporting background then, personally? Then, do you come from a cycling background or no sport background?
No. Definitely a cyclist. We've been working a little bit too hard this year getting this out. So my cycling is a bit lacking at the moment. But I've Australian amateur world championships, the Fondos. I've represented Australia 5 times, I think now. But actually, my wife's the real star of the family. So she's still goes all right. I think she did her last kind of race with some professionals when she was 48 to 49, dating us. And she was quite happy to finish on Amanda Spratt's wheel. So, yeah.
So your wife is
Geraldine Blumfield Brown. She's just getting to triathlon, but she still goes pretty good. So yeah, I struggled to keep up with her up the hills. So
so is she a good test subject for Core?
All the time. So we test people we found working with one of the Olympic organizations. Instead of getting into climatic chambers, we put on a paint suit. So you look like you put on these white Tyvek paint suits. They work brilliant. So we've got the Wahoo bike sitting next to us. And And we do a lot with Wahoo too. And she looks like the Michelin man doing her workouts in the afternoon. And she's extremely fit right now and a strong believer in heat training. So, yeah.
Well, it's interesting. We're talking about heat training. You can see there's my indoor trainer. Yep. So you can just see the handlebar there with the towel on, which gives you a clue of how hot it gets in this shed. Yep. So listen, right, my experience, I come at this as a total layman. So my experience of body temperature, obviously we know we get too hot when we're in a road race or whatever, we have to take off layers. But my main experience is on the turbo. And that's when I experience the big sort of drop off. You know, you overheat and your power disappears. So I think my main question is what is happening there?
So the first thing is when you're doing efforts and you're starting to sweat, what's happening is your core body temperature is starting to rise, correct? And so your body starts to sweat as a cooling mechanism. That cooling mechanism, all it does is it diverts blood to the skin. And the evaporation process cools the skin, which cools the blood, which cools your body. So the first thing is when you do exercise, your temperature goes up. The second thing is when your temperature goes up, blood gets diverted from the muscles or is getting diverted to the skin, meaning there's less essentially oxygen into the muscles for producing power. It's that simple. It's like going up in altitude. You got less oxygen. The blood flow is being directed to the different areas. That's it. So as you get, and statistically, if you look at marathons, hot marathons are slower than cooler marathons. Hot time trials, your power numbers come down. And it's just because your body's diverting this blood flow, this energy supply to the skin instead into the working muscles. But there's stuff you can do about it and you can become more efficient. So...
Well, that's what we're going to get onto that. I mean, one of the things, the reason I wanted to speak to you in the first place, I was watching Paris-Nice, last week, and stage six, about 45 kilometers to go, Adam Blythe on the commentary, and they were speculating, I don't know which rider it was, but they had something poking out, a sensor clearly poking out under their suit. And they speculated that that was something to do with body temperature. First of all, was that you? Did you have a rider in Paris-Nice?
We have several teams that we're working with. Some could be, I can name a few teams that's there. And then we're working with other teams that just due to their arrangements, we're not really allowed to name yet. But I would say we're working with many teams at the moment. So, yep. And there's a lot of interest from the men's teams and from the women's side also. So we're working with some women's teams now also.
I was going to say, the interesting thing is, you know, we are, as cyclists, we absolutely hoover up data these days. We are bombarded with data and we seem to love interpreting our data and stuff. So with Core, we're going to get a whole new set of data about our body temperature. Why should we be monitoring that? I mean, is it because there are quick fixes that we can do to bring our temperature down? What are we going to learn from what we're measuring?
Yeah. It's, again, I'll try to make it real simple. As we mentioned earlier, is your core body temperature goes up, blood gets diverted away from the muscles to the skin for cooling. That means your power goes down. So what that means is you can compensate your effort. So if you're doing, let's say, a hill climb or a time trial, if your core body temperature is starting to increase, you can do your little mental math that you need to drop your FTP a little bit. So you need to drop your threshold level. It's a pacing tool. The other things to be really aware of is if you're in a road race, so if you're racing in a couple of weeks' time, before you get to the big climb, you're going to be very conscious of your temperature and you're going to be trying to do pre-cooling before you get there. Because as soon as you get these upper, as you're going uphill, you don't have the airflow. So that's where a lot of people's temperature goes up. So if we can start pre-cooling or strategically cooling, you're going to be a slight advantage than the other guys. So
I was going to say, I mean, this is stuff that's kind of been understood for a long time. We need to pour water ourselves, we need to cool ourselves down. But not in a sort of, we haven't had the formality of having the data in front of us, you know, on our head unit, for instance. I'm guessing that the head unit and what it's telling us might mean that we can be a bit more specific about what we do with a cooling strategy. You know, I just need to take it off a little bit, you know, take the edge off a little bit, you know.
Yeah, and it's just being aware. I mean, a lot of times you probably run with a power meter or a cadence sensor. Most of the time, we're pretty aware of what that is. But one of the things is a lot of us, because we don't have that, and you're aware of that because you have that feedback all the time. So you know about where your heart rate should be. You know about, I mean, generally, I know what my cadence is within pretty close, unless I'm screwing something up. But it's a way to reassure what we should know. But core temperature is one of these things that a lot of people, we don't have a good reference point. So unless you measure it and monitor it all the time, most people aren't aware how hot they're getting. I mean, we've got guys, we had a guy at the UAE, he was over 40 degrees, 40 and a half degrees. It just happens. And obviously he said he struggled and have a hard time to recover. So, that's it. So if he had been a little bit more aware or kind of inclined, you know, it could have, or had done a little bit more heat adaptation or a little bit of heat training beforehand, he could have done or performed a little bit better in those circumstances.
It's funny, you know, saying, you know, 40 degrees, I'm thinking I've got a baby in the house. And, you know, whenever my baby's near 40 degrees, then we're in the hospital. You know,
yeah, so but that's extreme. Some people, they get that hot and they operate fine. Yeah. I mean, most of the time, if you looked at your race, if you're doing any kind of effort, you're above 38 and a half degrees, pushing 39, and you're not even aware of it. You feel warm and stuff, but you're not really aware of it. But if you're homesick with a fever like that, you're usually pretty aware of it, and everyone else is around too. So, yeah, I mean, that's one thing that people are unaware of is how hot people get during these events. So, and it's normal. But it's also dangerous. If you operate in those temperatures for a long time, that is serious. Heat illnesses are really serious. You don't want to get one. And they can take 6 to 9 months to recover from. Your body doesn't like it, and it will do everything possible not to get in that situation again.
It's interesting. And you talked a bit about adaptation there, heat adaptation. So, you know, I mean, I guess a lot of these things are, you know, people have an optimum temperature that they race at. And amongst your riders, there'll be a big spectrum of riders, you know, some who prefer the cooler temperature, some guys, like you just say, can go up to, you know, and race with their temperature around in the 40s. But is there, can we, with the data you're giving us, can we train ourselves? You know, can we be more successful at operating when it's warm? You know, if, for instance, if I'm going to race the Tour de France, I know that I'm going to be facing some really hot summer days. You know, can I be adaptive training and will core allow me to sort of monitor that better? Yeah.
So first I want to make something clear and get rid of a misconception. You get that hot even in colder races. Okay. So it's your temperature is primarily going up based on effort. So that is the biggest contributor to core body temperature going up, less so than the day, more so on the effort. So if someone's doing full flat out, even on a cooler day, they can get up to those higher temperatures. You know, if no wind, big tailwind, or going up a hill and you're doing those efforts, I live in Switzerland and I climb up some of the mountains here in the wintertime. It's, you know, 4 or 5 degrees out and I'm still 39 and a half degrees. So it's more based on effort and then your cooling capacity. And so your second part of your question, can you do anything about it? Yeah, it's easy. What is training? We put our body in stress, in a certain stress, and your body adapts and gets better at it. So if you train, if you're on your bike next to you and you're on that, turn the fans off and purposely get your core body temperature up higher. You can do it on your easier tempo days. And what you're doing is you're just putting your body into that stress and your body's adapting. It's that simple. If you're doing Zwift races and things like that, we say train hot, race cold. So I was just talking to a friend racing the other weekend, and I gave him this advice, and he put his core on. And all he did, and he normally races with fans on, and all he did is he just used some cold towels and just did and had another fan. So that he didn't do anything else, just did that. And his normalized power was up 10 or 15 watts. And his heart rate was down, and he said he got done and he felt fresher than he did the week before. So it's not rocket science. It's real simple. So, but the problem, the thing we've been missing is being able to see this information and understand it. So,
So, well, that brings me on to what we haven't even touched on, the technology yet. So, you know, Core, what does Core look like?
Well, you've got a video, so you're at an advantage, and your listeners aren't. It's
I mean, what I'm looking at is a tiny white square, essentially.
Yeah, a tiny white square. Come to corebodytemp.com, and you can see it for yourself, or order one, and you can hold one yourself. It just clips onto your heart rate monitor. Or we also have medical patches that we just medical grade patches that people wear them 24 hours a day. And it clips onto your heart rate monitor. You just shake it before you go, turn it on, and that's it. It speaks ANT and BLE. So it works with your Garmin and Wahoo bike computers and smartwatches. We have a phone app and we push data to the cloud. So we're working on all the integration partners, working with other people. We have other partners we're in the process of adding native support to. And it's real simple, and it's a new sensor technology, which is the important part. So this sensor technology I mentioned earlier was developed in Switzerland, and it's not measuring skin temperature. It works on energy transfer. And I can explain how all that works if you want.
Yes, please. Okay. Yes, please. Yes,
so
please.
I'm going to have you help me with an experiment. So is it going to do this? Okay, everyone understands temperature, right? So as you've got a little kid, everyone kind of understands temperature as younger. So I'm going to, if we're doing an experiment, I got my safety glasses here. I come prepared.
He is putting safety goggles on.
And I even have a fire extinguisher just in case it goes wrong.
Okay, here we go. Now,
actually, it's simple. It's very simple. So all I want you to do is take your hand out and tell me what the temperature is. Is it 21.2 or 22 or 19.8?
I don't know. Yeah. No, I got no idea.
I thought you knew what temperature. You told me you knew what temperature was.
Well, listen. I'm in the shed, so it's. I would have said room temperature, but I'm half outdoors.
Okay, that's part of my point. So the next thing is, I want you to grab two different types of materials, sort of like I've got a book. It needs something with mass and nothing that's powered, so it can't be your something that didn't come out of the refrigerator. Something that's kind of been sitting around the room. So one hand, I have a book.
This just shows how insane it is where I am. I've got a walkie-talkie. And a padlock.
Perfect.
Okay.
Perfect. Okay. Yeah. And well, I have a book and a fire extinguisher. Okay. And now I want you to do take one in each hand and tell me which one's warmer and which one's colder.
Oh, you know what? I'm holding this padlock. That's metallic. So surely it feels colder, right?
Exactly.
Colder.
No, they're both exactly the same temperature. But you were right on. You said it feels colder. So what it is, as humans, we're terrible thermometers. We don't really sense temperature. What we sense is energy transfer. You grab that metal, it's metallic. It pulls more energy out of you, so it feels colder. And you pull up the plastic walkie-talkie, it pulled less energy out of you, so it feels warmer. So our sensor technology measures exactly what you feel. So how it works then is if we know the energy transfer, you can, through a lot of math and other kind of stuff, the simplified is you can figure out the energy source. So it's the same thing if I put it on the outside of the cup, I can figure out the temperature of the water in the inside.
Wow.
And that's how it works. Oversimplified, 6 years of clinical trials.
So for me, so even if I pick one up tomorrow, you know, I've got, you can see it here, I've got my Wahoo unit on my bike. Does that, will a standard Wahoo read the data?
Yep.
The field is there, the field exists.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
so right now, I can say we're getting native, we've got a new ANT profile. That we've been working with Dynastream, Ant Plus, Garmin with. It's called CoreTemp. And Wahoo shortly will have a native version of it. But right now, to sneak it in, Chip from Wahoo had a great idea. We sneak it in another one. So a sensor that's not commonly used. We use the muscle oxygen sensor, and we sneak it in there. And so that's recorded there now. and that sneaks it into Training Peaks. So we've got native support, and there will be better native support in the very near future. So, and on the Garmins, we use a Connect IQ field, and that's and so that's what a lot of the pro world pro teams are using and top triathletes. So, and it was a good way to get it in there really quick. So we're just trying to work in that whole existing data ecosystem.
So the pro teams that are using it, and you said in an email that you've signed up more. You know, there's quite a few people.
Yep. I have got three I can talk about. So yep.
Great. Well, great. Well, and but what are they? So they're trialing it. Do you give them any advice about what to do with the data that they are seeing and how to use it? And what are they doing with it?
Well, I can't disclose everything.
Of course.
Yeah.
We understand.
So I would just say that they're monitoring the riders, and what every team is doing is slightly different. But one is they're doing what we were just talking about. So they're trying to understand the riders better, you know, the adaptation and understanding pacing better. And it's a whole new metrics that they're doing. Some of the teams are very interested in 24-hour monitoring, because there's a lot to go, it shows a lot when you're monitoring people 24 hours a day. I can talk about that a little bit too, because that's...
Go for it.
We're a little off topic, but I'm trying to... So there's, as we were talking about temperature, most people, so if I ask you, what's a standard temperature? What's a normal temperature? So this is a question again for you. So what's a normal temperature?
Listen, I've got a baby, so I'm going to say 37 degrees.
37 degrees. That's a good answer.
That's what we like to see.
That's a good answer. But the truth is the temperature varies throughout the day. So usually when you...
Do you know what? It's funny you mention that, because if you ever take my little boy's temperature when he's asleep, like, he's like 35. It's like, you know, sort of hyperthermic, but he's fine.
Yeah. So that's exactly correct. When you sleep, your temperature usually drops. And then during the day, your temperature goes up. And if you do a slight activity, your temperature usually rises again a little bit. But it's not a static thing. Most people, I used to think the same way. I thought, oh, temperature is just static all the time. And it's not. It actually varies quite a bit. And so this variation, especially when you sleep, is called your circadian cycle. And your circadian cycle shows a lot about your health and wellness. That's what jet lag, we can see jet lag. It's basically your circadian cycle gets out of whack. So your that's jet lag, burnout or fatigue. The circadian cycle gets flatter, so the change is there. And we're actually working with researchers where we do early detection of Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's. Yeah. So there's some really great programs that we're involved in. And really quite happy, you know, quite proud to be involved in that. We think we can not only provide a really cool, you know, technology for sports and useful information, but it's rare that you can work on a product that not only is it, we think, is a good opportunity, but can actually do some good long-term good in the long-term, do some real positive things for society. So.
Ian, you were telling me that during your time at Sky in particular, you actually experimented with measuring core temperature of riders.
Well, yeah, we did some similar stuff. I mean, you know, there was obviously Sky and British Cycling had, you know, put a lot of time and kind of resource into preparing for specific events, especially when you think about, you know, Olympics or, you know, stuff on the track where, you know, you're in a very controlled environment. So I remember back in, must have been 2014, I think I was going 2014 or 2015, I was going to race in the Middle East, I think in Dubai, Tour of Dubai. And prior to departing, we were in Mallorca at a training camp, and we did some, I guess at the time it was like some sweat testing. So we had these little patches that we, you know, slapped on our arm, and they could, I guess, measure kind of the salinity of the sweat that you were producing. So for a week straight, we went into a room at the team hotel, set up the kickers and our bikes. They cranked the heat up and had some extra heaters. So in a 35 degree Celsius room, Fahrenheit, I don't even know what that is, close to 90, 95. So they measured our kind of the sweat salinity or our sweat rate based off of the heat. And what they noticed is that over a week of even just doing, you know, 30 to 45 minutes in the morning in a heated room, that we were becoming more efficient at sweating. And, you know, as you know, we just heard, you know, that you can train your body to be more efficient in the heat. And, you know, there's multiple things, just cooling, but also the way in which you're sweating. I mean, oftentimes, I'm sure people in the UK, same with here in New England, you know, you have that first hot day of the year and you go out and you sweat and do a big ride and you're just, your kit is caked in salt. And it's because your body's just inefficient at cooling at that point in time, but it can be trained and you can be, you know, you can improve on it.
Was it something that you trained then after learning this sort of stuff? Was it something you worked out? Or did, I mean, I'm guessing when you were coming up to something like the Tour de France, you would do some work on adapting to the heat. I guess just by training in Europe in general, you get gradually adapted anyway. But imagine would you have done some particular training things?
Yeah, no, I definitely did some kind of heat-specific training. And especially, you know, in the early season when I knew I was going to race, you know, oftentimes down in Australia or the Middle East, you know, first race of the year. And, you know, while it's nice and warm where I lived in Nice, it's not hot. So I actually went quite a few times in the week leading up to that race and did some Bikram yoga. I think it's maybe been changed now to just called hot yoga.
Yeah, I don't think they mention Bikram anymore, do they?
Yeah, but anyways, it was, you know, in an incredibly hot room and you would just sweat so much. And just kind of to get, you know, it's a way to get used to kind of increasing your core temperature and training your body to be adaptive and prepared to, you know, perform in heat. Funny enough, my younger brother used to race back when, goodness, maybe 10, 15 years ago. And he had a coach that, the U.S. Nationals were down in Augusta, Georgia, which is super hot and humid. And where we grew up in Oregon wasn't nearly as hot or humid. So he had him doing some, you know, training rides with, you know, leg warmers, rain jacket, you know, almost like a boxer getting out there and just sweating it out. But just as a way to kind of adapt and you know, prepare for warmer weather. You know, and interesting enough, I don't know what INEOS is doing now. And I think, you know, things have changed, but I'm sure people have seen that a lot of pro riders will take an ice sock, especially in a hot day, and they'll, you know, fill, you know, the soigneurs and carers will fill a you know, I guess a stocking with ice, and then riders will throw it down their back. But for a long while, Tim Karrison at Team Sky wasn't a big fan of this. And especially you see riders with cooling vests in time trials, and, you know, I grew up doing the same thing, like, oh, how can I stay as, you know, keep my core temperature as cool as possible in my warm up before a time trial. But Tim's theory was that, you know, you're almost artificially telling your body that it's cooler than it is, and it can become very easy to, you know, especially in an event like a time trial that's, you know, relatively short and, you know, focused and you're riding to a specific power or, you know, speed, whatever it is from the start. And so he was worried that riders would, you know, kind of artificially be able to produce too much power, or, you know, kind of trick their body into thinking that it's colder, because it's, you know, it's well known that, you know, you can perform better in cooler weather. So riders would go out and actually kind of, you know, blow up, you know, 20 minutes into a time trial because their core temperature was rising above, you know, what the body actually thought it was. But that said, you know, cold water and a nice sock on a super hot day does feel incredibly nice. So I'm sure there's some research out there, but it's kind of this fine balance between, you know, feeling cool, but actually, you know, being cool and actually, you know, again, just training your body to be able to, you know, operate in those hotter temperatures.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thanks, as ever, to our long-term partners, Science in Sport. They've been with the Cycling Podcast, well, for longer than I have. And as we've been talking about core temperature on this episode of Service Course, should remind you that Science in Sport do have a range of cooling products designed to cool you down when you're out on the road or doing a big session on the turbo. They've been tried and tested by the Cycling Podcast. I've got to say, I love them. If you want to get 25% off your next Science in Sport order, just go to scienceinsport.com and enter the offer code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Well, the must-have items over a period of lockdown have been turbo trainers. I've got a Wahoo kicker, so you'd be pleased to know. That was my lockdown investment. You invested in the other must-have lockdown product, which is a dog.
I did, yes. My wife and I picked up an English lab last September. His name is Winston. He's almost 50 pounds now. He's a handful, but it's been really fun to have a puppy through this time, especially when we're not seeing, you know, a ton of other people. I think the other big purchase, or maybe not financially big, but kind of time-consuming purchase that people got into was chickens. So we had 20 chickens. We've lost two to either a raccoon or an owl. But so we have 18 chickens now and a puppy that keep us busy and happy and entertained. And chickens provide more than enough eggs than we can possibly eat.
You paint a really vivid picture of this sort of frontier type life that you're living out there. It's amazing. Listen, Ian, thanks ever so much. And if people want to see puppy pictures, where do they find you?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram. It's Ian Boswell, and you can find me there. I do have a Twitter. I don't use it very often, but I think that's at the Boz 91. And Rick Zobel used to always make fun of me for my Instagram handle, but I made that long before I knew that I should have just made it my name. But it's probably taken by now.
Do you know what? I still refer to him as World Tour Rick. I got that from you.
Rick's a funny guy. We still stay in touch, and you know, he's definitely a German fashionista.
Well, thanks to Ian for joining me. He's not here for this second part because this interview only happened at the last minute. It's been one I've been trying to get for quite a while. I was fascinated at the launch of the update for Trainer Road, which introduces adaptive training and machine learning in order to improve the workouts you get and respond to the way your body is feeling. Something you would get with a regular, you know, human coach, but something that the online platforms haven't done yet. So this is brand new. It's really, really exciting. And they make some bold predictions, including that in 20 years' time, maybe less, there'll be no need for human coaches at all. Pretty frightening for any of the coaches out there. I hope the machines don't take away your jobs, because you are fantastic people. So this is my chat with Jonathan Lee from Trainer Road, and it is fascinating stuff.
Adaptive training is what I brought you here to talk about, really. I use Trainer Road all the time. I'm not using the adaptive training, and I do experience what you described. You know, some days I'm like, I am absolutely crushing this. And other days it's like, even though I'm on a program that is bespoke to me, essentially, and I've tweaked here and there, some days I'll come to it expecting to be great, and I'm dead. So tell me about adaptive training, how it works, and why it should eliminate that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so it's really, there's kind of like a myth of like perfect training plan, right? Like a perfect plan exists and it'll always be perfect. The reason that that's a myth is because training, effective training, is really training that's meeting you as an athlete, as an individual. And in order to do that, your training needs to be able to adapt, but it also needs to be looking at the right things to make those sort of decisions. So what adaptive training aims to do is train you as an individual. And the way that we do that is by using machine learning to be able to remove a lot of human error from the process, but also use a massive pool of data to be able to make educated decisions that just the human mind can't really comprehend. We have millions upon millions of workouts that people have done with Trainer Road workouts, right? Where we have this data set, and it has planned output versus actual output. And that's hugely valuable. And then we also know historically what they were doing leading up to that, what they did after it, what their intent was. So we have this really valuable user base or a database from all of these subscribers to Trainer Road that have done all of these workouts. And then we have many, many, many times more activities that are just rides or races or group rides or anything that you're doing outside. And when athletes sign up for Trainer Road and they sync Strava, all that data gets pulled in. We are able to then see that data with this great context of being able to see what actually makes people faster, what doesn't make people faster, what patterns exist, what sort of differences exist when a specific person trains this energy system versus another energy system, how those relate to each other. All these things, we've been able to pull this all together, and then we've trained machine learning so that it can understand that data in a really great way. And the way that we really started with this was training it to understand when a workout is what we would call, we classify it as a failure, but it's basically it's important to communicate the fact that I'm not sure, as long as you've tried the workout, I'm not sure there's anything that's would be constituted as a failure, because it's great data. So, but failures, struggles, passes, and then what we call a super pass, which is when you really blow, those are the days when you feel great and you're just blowing your targets out of the water, right?
I feel like you're looking at all my data here, because there's a lot of those days in mine. There's a lot.
Yeah, right. The system's able to classify those, and it's able to do so at an effectively, not an infinite scale, but across everything all at the same time, and able to comprehend all of that. And as a result, we were able to really get a fix on exactly how hard, when you're doing 30 30s and you have four sets of those and they're 20 minutes each and you have 6 minutes rest in between, how that compares to VO2 intervals when you're doing 6 minutes and it's at like 106% or 105%, something like that. That's right on that boundary between threshold and VO2. And we're able to actually get a quantifiable measure of how difficult that is, how difficult it should be, and how difficult it should be for a specific person. So that's step one. After we have that done, then we can start to go through and analyze every person's workout with machine learning. And then it learns and it says, okay, the next workout this person needs is actually this workout. And if you have gone through, done a workout, we have this objective measure of your data. You get fed a survey thereafter that basically asks you, how did that workout feel? And that's the subjective data. When you put those two things together, then we have a very clear path on how to adjust your plan so that you feel like you're getting the right workout every time. And what it does is, you know, kind of wrapping this all back to your main point there, is it allows your life to bring in all the different variables and complications that exist in life, whether that's with kids, work. You went out and you did a really hard group ride and it was a ton of fun, but as a result, you're probably not going to be able to hit your next targets during your workout. It allows for all that. So then that way, you can come back to your training and it can always be adjusting for you and right in that spot where you feel like, once again, it's the right workout every time. So that's the goal. You know, we're focused on just making athletes faster, and that's our entire focus. And this is a huge step toward us, I think, completely changing how people train so that more people can get faster and do so on a more consistent basis. It's really exciting.
I'm really interested. I mean, when you talk about things like AI and machine learning and bringing those into cycling, that's when I get really fascinated. I guess it's been quite a steep learning curve for you, people like yourself. I mean, machine learning, we probably need to explain what that is. I mean, obviously, it's the kind of computer learning about you and what you do and taking that data and process it. But obviously, it means something more specific than that.
Correct. Yeah. And there are folks that are much more qualified at answering such things here at Train Road. We have a full data science team and people that understand this at a wonderful level. And meanwhile, I'm far from it. I can give you the basics of really kind of the basic concepts. Really what you're doing is you're trying to train the machine. What you're doing is training it to be able to learn. And the way that we actually did that, and let's talk about like the workout classifications, for example, like we were talking about before. We would take large batches, you know, of hundreds and thousands of workouts and pull those in. And then we would go through and have multiple people go through and classify those workouts and say, this workout is a success. This one is a struggle. This one is a super pass. This one is a failure, you know, that sort of a thing. And we'd go through and mark them. And then after multiple people would mark them, we'd review them together, reach consensus on them, because sometimes there was a disagreement like, no, that one's actually just a pass. It's not a super pass, or that one's actually a struggle, not a pass. So we'd go through that, identify all those, reach consensus, and then we would feed that in to machine learning or to our algorithm. And what you're doing is you're trying to give it consistent results so it can start to recognize trends and consistencies. So we did this with huge amounts of workouts over time, and it's been years in the making and going through. And then at some point, what you do is you then say, okay, so let's give this next batch to the humans as well as the machine learning system, and we'll see what the classifications are. So then it would spit them out, and then we would spit ours out, so to speak, and then we'd be able to compare. And then that allows you to then improve it even further. And then at some point, it actually gets better than humans, is what we've experienced, in the sense that a lot of the time we would say, oh, well, this one actually looks like a struggle. And it would say, no, this one's actually a pass, because for this workout, the intention is to achieve time and intensity between this and this percentage. And even though it looks like they were struggling through there, if it looks at that and then it considers heart rate and it considers what they've been doing recently, everything else, it actually qualifies as this. So it's kind of like, okay, the system is way better at us now. And as a result, it then only gets better. And so that's an example of basically, I think it's called a model or something, basically an input that we feed into machine learning, which is the objective performance data. But then there are so many other things that we can pull in the future. We can't wait to bring in different data from activity trackers, which we have all, you know, we'll be able to bring in all that data seamlessly. So if you're tracking it now, that's all you have to do. You don't have to import it into Trainer Road or anything, but that will allow us to bring in further inputs to tweak it even further and to get an even more precise look at how your performance is going. And there are just many, many different things. We have, a lot of models that we have currently inputting into our machine learning system. I hesitate to provide a number, but it is a lot. And we continue to add to that regularly. So the whole concept here is that, you know, it's humans are not immune from bias for sure. We're also, we shouldn't stray away from using experience. That's very helpful. We also shouldn't stray away from using data points that we have, but we bump up against limits in the sense that we're a finite mind and we're only able to comprehend a certain amount of things at once. And then our perspective is always affected by what we've experienced as well. And while that can be beneficial, it can also be detrimental when you're dealing with training athletes at scale, a huge amount of them. So this allows us to just really, it's the picking of the workouts. We can do so efficiently with machine learning so that, once again, sounds like a broken record, but you feel like you get the right workout at every time. And that's just an incredible feeling. And we felt that before, because it's when you get that workout and you're like, oh, this is great. It didn't break me into the ground. It was challenging. I did it. And when every single workout feels like that, that is extremely motivating. It's fantastic.
It's interesting you said that, because actually previously I was on, say, maybe between 7 to 9 hours a week, but life gets in the way. And a lot of the time I was probably doing about as much training as I'm doing now, but I was leaving a lot of workouts incomplete or they were unsatisfying. And then I stripped it back down. I didn't want to 5 to 6 hours, but I'm regularly completing my whole week's training. And my, you know, my self-esteem is better for that, at the very least. Do you know what I mean? That's the effect.
It's a profound effect. Like, so one of the most, the common thread we see across athletes that are seeing the most improvement is consistency with their training. It's really hard to be consistent when you failed that workout and then you struggled because you didn't have enough time or because life stress intervened. And if you have that routinely, then it gets really difficult to become motivated to get back on the bike. You'd think that it would be easier in the sense that, like, oh, you'd really want to get back on the horse, but it's tough. We all know that. Like, once you've struggled, a lot of the time we have this perfectionism within us where we want to hit our marks perfectly. And then as soon as we just miss one point, then we suddenly think, oh, okay, we should just throw the whole thing out. That's human nature. And this really does help account for that. And it helps athletes stay on track. In the future, it'll be fantastic because we're collecting all this data and we'll be able to suggest that athletes should be training with less or more volume. We'll be able to suggest that they should be training with one training methodology or another, like a polarized model, or perhaps one that's more of a pyramidal model, like a traditional one that you would see. All of these things will be able to be brought in, and then our ML system will be able to say, hey, this is best for you right now, and make those adjustments. So then life can intervene. I think that we, as athletes, have a bad habit of filling up any spare space with training to the point where it's 100% of that is just filled right up. And it gives us no wiggle room, so that life, when it comes and brings us even a small interruption, it really causes a lot of chaos. So this will undoubtedly go to help athletes just be more consistent and be able to train within their realm of capabilities, but get the most out of the training that they can have with that. So super exciting. Yeah.
And there's been some pretty ear-catching claims, you know, and I don't know if we take some of these things with a pinch of salt, but the idea that, you know, the human coach might be obsolete in the next two decades. I mean, obviously, there are people like yourself, you know, who are managing these systems. So, you know, but is that something that you can see? You know, can this do it better than a human can do it? You know, I think for me, what I see as the benefit of having a coach is the coach will listen to me and I say, look, I can't do this. I'm not feeling up to this. What should I do instead? You know, do you think it can compensate for all that?
I think that that's an important point to clarify. I think that in terms of picking workouts, a machine learning system or artificial intelligence will become better than a human at that, right? But that's such a small factor or a small value prop for a coach. Like if a coach comes to me and says, well, I'm going to, you know, pick good workouts and that's it, I would say, I want more out of you, coach, if I'm going to be paying you this. What a coach is really valuable for, I find the most valuable, I should say, because they're valuable in many aspects, but what they're most valuable for is in that accountability partner, in the knowledge source that you can lean upon that's going to be answering the questions that you might have. It's a coach that's going to be able to be a support system when things are difficult, that sort of thing. And I don't think that, I think technology will forever enhance that, but I'm not sure that it would necessarily replace that. And as a result, I think that a coach, but we can see this, if a coach understands his value is just picking workouts, he's probably missing a lot of the potential that he could give to his athletes. But if a coach understands his value much further than that as being a confidant and really this partner that elevates their athletes in that respect, then I think a coach sees their true value. That won't be replaced. But yeah, this is going to pick workouts better than that. And I see a lot of coaches, in the future, coaches will use systems like this. And they would never think of just saying, well, I have this library of 37 workouts and that's what I always pick from. And so I'll just, you know, make small tweaks and adjustments to those and give them to my athletes. That will probably in the future seem silly, just as these days it seems silly to think that we wouldn't all have a phone in our pocket or a computer in our pocket, right? But I think that it's symbiotic there. I think they'll both use the tool, or coaches will use this tool to be able to make athletes faster.
So. Well, I've got a couple more questions for you. The first one, as a user of Trainer Road, what will I see? So at the moment, I open my app and I see, and this is the same for whatever training platform you're using. You know, I'll open my app and I'll see a calendar, so I know what workout I've got tomorrow. I'll know what workout I've got this time next week. When I'm using the adaptive training, will I still see this, or will it just be like a question mark? And then, you know, the day after that day, I'll find out what it is that I'm doing. Is that how what I'll see as a user?
So the way that this works is that we have training plans that give you somewhat of a true north. Like, you know, when you use Plan Builder and you build out your training plan for whatever you're preparing for, it knows that it basically, the way our system will see that is it wants to bring key markers to a certain point, right, by a certain date. So there's a true north, so to speak, that it's working toward with your training. So as a result, you'll still see your plan laid out, and that plan will be on your calendar and it will be subject to change, right? So it will be laid out all the way until your date. But then as you complete a workout, the way that you actually use adaptive training is you just train. And then after you train, you fill out that quick survey that asks you when it was success. You know, when you pass the workout, it'll say, how'd that workout feel? If you failed with that workout, it will say, you know, what was the reason behind that? If you struggled, it will ask you what the reason is behind that. So you just fill out the survey. It's one click. And then that's it. After that, you just look at your calendar and it'll say adaptations are pending. So then you click on that and then it'll say this workout is going to change to this workout and this one's going to change to this one. And it analyzes and makes those changes per block. So even though it may be the first week in a 6-week block, it will potentially make changes all the way up to even 6 weeks out for you. But it could tweak that any specific workout at the end of that training plan. It could tweak it effectively every single day as it makes those changes based on what you're doing. So you'll see your training plan. It's still trying to bring you to a specific point, but it will do so at your own pace. And it will do so allowing you to be able to get the ideal amount of improvement for you. Like the way that I kind of think of this is it's more or less if you have point A and point B and a training plan's goal is to get you to point B. Before that was a static point. And it was trying to bring you up in this trajectory, but your trajectory wasn't linear and it's difficult to be able to get there. now that static point is more fluid. It's still far enough along. It's at the same point on the x-axis, right, as it once was, but it may be different on the y-axis because what it's going to do is adjust to you as it gets you there. So yeah, you'll still see your plan and it just makes adjustments. All you do is do the workout, fill out the survey, and then after that, accept the adaptations it gives you.
I mean, listen, your mind must just be fizzing with possibilities because mine is as well. So I'm thinking about, you know, I've just done a chat with the guys at Core who make a core temperature sensor, which obviously it's extra data. We've had things like it's Whoop, isn't it, that sort of monitors almost like sort of circadian rhythms, you know, sort of the most effective times to train and stuff. And we can see more and more of this stuff coming in and then feeding into it. And I can see a future whereby the machine learning is not only telling you what training to do, but when to do it. And, you know, even the fueling you will need around it. Your mind must be fizzing with the possibilities.
Oh yeah. And that's like a really special thing about being in cycling, in the sense that we have this really objective measure of power. Since we have that measure of work that an athlete does with the power meter, and it's so representative of what was actually done, that allows so many possibilities. That's why data that can come from something like you mentioned, like all the different fitness trackers that a person might be wearing or any sort of device like that, that's why that data becomes valuable, because you have this actual reliable constant upon which you can rely that is the power data, the actual performance. So there's, I mean, you know, limitless is definitely hyperbole, but at the same time, I think that that is an accurate description of what we could do with this, right? And this is the future. This is what everyone will do. We're excited to be the first ones really taking this big step forward with it. But it's the future. It's what everyone will do. All of these data points that we can get are just going to make everything more optimized for us. It's cool.
This AI element, it almost sounds like a new member of staff, the way you're talking about it. Have you given it a name? I feel like you've given it a name.
We did have a name prior to it, but I don't want to reveal the name because it should be some sort of like Easter egg that maybe someday will be revealed. But yes, it did have a very much, you know, a covert name that we assigned to it. And it's exciting. And it is kind of like it's a huge part of our company and what moves our company forward. So yeah, in many respects, it is, you know, personified in that regard, in the sense that like this is a big part of what's moving our company forward. And it's doing more than if we did it with hiring a huge amount of coaches. It's doing far more than that. So it's exciting.
I keep coming up with other questions. Is it this? I promise you, this is the last one. But obviously, what it's doing, what the idea is, you know, you've got this big stash of workouts, and this knows the sort of the right workout to give to the person at the right time. I was just wondering whether it might start creating its own workouts from the workouts that you have.
Yeah, eventually that will be the case. And as of right now, if anybody looks at our workout catalog, you'll notice that it's increasing rapidly in terms of number of workouts. And the reason for that is because it's doing that right now. It's recognizing, hey, we have a hole right here in this regard for training this energy system in this specific way. We need to fill in these gaps with workouts that would allow an athlete to have a more linear trajectory. So and eventually that will happen. You know, a common question is people ask, like, will it make an adjustment in the middle of my workout and you know, kind of make a tweak? But the interesting thing with that is that it's kind of like, imagine if you're taking a test in school and you're taking a test, then suddenly the questions start adjusting because you aren't performing the way you were, or you're overperforming, and as a result, it changes them. As a result, you kind of actually lose your basis for comparison to be able to then say, across the class, how did that athlete perform? Or compared to previous situations, how did that athlete perform? So we don't, as of now, we don't believe that the answer is actually making adjustments in the middle of the workout to the current workout, but rather having a baseline to compare the athlete against, seeing how they perform with that, and then making subsequent changes to the upcoming training. What that allows us to do is actually get a fix on the athlete's abilities, a better fix than making the adjustments midway through. The other part with that too is if we make those adjustments halfway through, so imagine you're following a training plan, and training is hard. That's the nature of it. It shouldn't be easy. If it was, then it wouldn't really be productive, right? So it's hard. You're doing workouts, but you know that if you start to struggle, your workout won't get hard. It's just going to get a little bit easier. Subconsciously, we will likely put ourselves in a situation where we then start to underachieve because of the fact that we know that it's going to adjust and we'll take that. And then the signal that we would get from that is that, okay, the athlete, you know, needed to make those changes. And as a result, we shouldn't give them harder work next time. So it can create kind of like a spiral where an athlete starts going kind of downward and falling off of that true north trajectory. So it's a really important thing to make sure that you have a system of checks and balances. And that's our objective feedback of the prescribed work and subjective feedback of the athlete's perception of it. And when you have those two things combined with what are the outcomes that we're hoping to achieve for the athlete, then you can always have that system of checks and balances so the athlete's training never spirals away from its original target.
So my final question, and I think you can probably telegraph what this is going to be. How do I get to use it?
Yeah. So right now everyone can sign up for the closed beta. It's at trainerroad.com/AT, makes it super easy. And you can sign up for access to that. We've been adding people and we're adding another batch today. We continue to add people on, and it's this process of find a bug, squash a bug as we discover these new edge cases, as we roll it out to more people. And what that's allowing us to do is build up momentum and make this, refine this even further so that then we can release it to public beta. And then after public beta, we can release it to everybody in production. So that's the best way to sign up for it. And we've been adding in people very regularly since we launched this, which is really exciting. And it's already, we're getting fantastic feedback from people that are like, I didn't realize training could be like this. Like it isn't destroying me every day, or wow, it's finally feeling like it's challenging me enough, because certain athletes, you know, feel the, or they're on the other end of this spectrum. So super fun. And that's how you can get access to it. You can stay tuned to the Trainer Road forum and our blog, and of course podcast and everything else to be able to get updates on it. And that's the best way.
This episode of Service Course was produced by me. Our theme music is Beyond the Black Veil by the brilliant Moscow Youth Cult. Do go and check them out. And the rest of the tracks in the show come via Epidemic Sound. For details of the individual tracks, then please check the show notes. Thanks again.